Welcome to the Unfair Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Unfair Podcast. My name is Pierre Ortlieb. I'm the head of policy analysis at Unfair. Today I'm speaking to Torbjörn Hammark, who is the head of strategic asset allocation at the Swedish pension fund AP3. We have a really interesting conversation for you today, covering all sorts of things from Torbjörn's reaction to the initial pandemic shock, the global policy response to the shock in March and April, and how it roiled financial markets, and some interesting questions and discussion on ESG integration in public pension fund portfolios. So thank you for joining us today and hope you enjoy the podcast. Torbjörn, thank you for joining us. I want to start off by asking you a broad question about what was going through your mind around the time the COVID-19 pandemic really took off in the West in March 2020. Obviously, it was an extremely volatile period for financial markets. There's been a lot of attention on pension funds, especially here in the UK, and how their margining practices may have contributed to some of the turmoil. But very broadly speaking, let's start off with how you made sense of the financial market episode and its kind of repercussions across different countries, different asset classes.
No, thanks, Pierre. Complicated question. I think you also need to take into at least 1 year after the fact, much more than 1 year actually. To by now, you have to sort of take in your personal situation and feelings and situation as well. And on a personal basis, me and my family had just come back from a 1 week in Dubai on vacation. That was the last week of February, and I remember that was really the week when everything sort of broke loose. It was boiling before, but then that was really the week when the market started to react. And I have been surprised initially how markets actually responded late January, early February. It was actually positive market reaction. The market was thinking that this thing going on in China is going to make the Chinese authorities stimulate the economy. So this is good for markets. I thought that was taking it a bit too far, to be honest. I think if you listen to people who had the experience around pandemic developments, even if this kind of experience has not been seen before, you kind of got the feeling that this could spread and this could hit the global economy at some stage, even if it was impossible to say when. And also after a few days down in Dubai, going home on the airplane or arriving at the Dubai airport, it was a chaos and everybody had masks on, and it was an acute feeling of that something big was going on. And then coming back to Stockholm, Arlanda, it was as nothing happened. It was just easy to cross the border, no masks on, and very easy to get home. So it was obvious that something was going on out in the world, in the global sphere, that at that point in time hadn't hit Sweden. It was quite striking. So that sort of tells you that even if something is boiling out there, it's really hard for authorities and countries to react. And the second personal note, that my oldest daughter was leaving for Costa Rica a week later, and I sort of sensed that was going to be trouble, but I let her go anyway. It probably tells you something about me as a father, good experience, and I thought, and it really became a good experience. But just a few days after she had left, the Trump administration closed borders to Europe, and that was the first surprise that hit me. I did not expect that. So that was interesting. And of course, at the same time, the market started to react more severe on the downside. To try to answer your question, I very early on tried to model this from how should I view this? What is this happening? And my line of reasoning was a comparison to the global financial crisis or great financial crisis just over a decade earlier, which turned out to be a poor model maybe, but I thought this was different for two reasons. First of all, this was not primarily a financial crisis. And my thinking was that because it's not a financial crisis, it's going to be much tougher to counteract or counterbalance by monetary policy and other policies. So that was one thinking that made me a bit more pessimistic about the market and economical outlook, to be honest. And the other contrast I made with the GFC was that this is a global economic crisis. This is not made in the US or made in the UK, like pretty much the financial crisis was. This is global. So that was my second thought of why this is going to be severe. So you can sort of, from my reasoning, you can sort of conclude that I was a bit too cautious maybe in terms of where the market was going to be 6 months later or 12 months later. So that was my initial thinking. And then we can move on to what actually happened in our portfolios, if you like.
Yeah, that would be great. So you've sketched out, I think, the early phase and how you started thinking about the shock. Interesting for me that you chose the financial crisis. I think a lot of people, if I remember correctly, were thinking about the SARS epidemic in the early 2000s or mid 2000s and how that had sort of a fairly limited impact on markets and on the global economy. And that obviously turned out to be quite a bad analogy as well. So we've established that kind of frame of thinking. And so why don't you, as you said, walk us through the way you, your portfolio reacted to market developments, what exactly you implemented, things like that. Let's go there next, I think.
I guess my excuse for my line of thinking there was that we were basically in the middle of the chaos. So I guess that comparison with the financial crisis took form middle of March, something like that. So it was sort of already very chaotic in markets. And I think people had by then sort of abandoned the relatively mild comparisons to the other flu periods that you related to. So that's probably sort of fair in a sense, fair comparison. No, what happened at the same time, which made us at least on the constructive side, was that we have in our investment process started or just implemented a new, what we call operative benchmark. And that was a benchmark that stems from our ALM analysis. How can we reach our long-term return targets and so on. And the most important point in relation to this period was that we had already decided to increase our equity exposure a bit and to basically start to build a credit exposure again in our portfolio. So we were very focused on that almost at the same time as markets became very, very volatile. So from a strategic perspective, we were very focused on actually reestablishing this portfolio exposure not too far from our operative benchmark, if you see what I mean. So our focus was clear in a sense, what to do over the next month or couple of weeks or the next few months. So in that sense, obviously the market developments presented themselves as a great opportunity for us to re-establish the portfolio exposure we seeked. And the lesson from that to me is this very high value of working with a strategic benchmark, which is your go-to zone when you have no strong opinions sort of deviating from that strategic benchmark. We have been working with similar kind of setups for a long time, and I have done so too, but that was a very important lesson. And of course, it turned out to be a very important lesson given that markets came back so quickly.
Yeah. So you were set on a course that was based on your strategic benchmarks. And actually, as you said, it sounds like the crisis was in some sense an opportunity to build up those exposures that you were laser focused on. You mentioned earlier one thing that I thought was interesting about how I believe you were referring to like January, February, when there was an expectation in markets that the initial phase of the COVID shock in China would unleash Chinese stimulus, and that was actually paradoxically quite good for markets for a period of time. And obviously there's been a lot of tension in some sense between, on the one hand, the kind of extraordinarily accommodative policy response from global central banks and policymakers, as well as, you know, the buoyancy of markets and the reality of the COVID situation, which is in some places getting worse and worse. So can you help us understand from your perspective, how did the global policy response to the initial shock in like March and April impact your thinking about the pandemic, about your portfolio construction, about macro trends? Maybe let's tackle that next.
Yes, absolutely. And remember that my comparative analysis to the global financial crisis left me in a relatively dark place in terms of that this is a global crisis. This is not easy to fix with monetary policy and so on. So my sort of strategic inclination was a bit on the negative side, I would say, and what that led me to focus a lot on was to actually raise liquidity in the portfolio. And that sounds at odds with me just saying that we wanted to increase risk to come closer to our operative benchmark. But that is actually the same thing. It's to be able to buy credits and increase your equity exposure. You basically must have cash, right? So it was super important for us to be able to sell relatively liquid assets like U.S. treasuries, turn them into cash and then invest them in more risky assets. So that chain of events that it is possible to do that is super important for us as a long-term investor and for markets in general, for markets to function. And I think that was a prime policy goal for the Fed and for other central bankers to have their bond markets to function, to make people sort of forget that sometimes, I think, in that discussion that, well, of course, we need a liquid treasury market, we need a liquid bond market, but you don't really ask yourself, why do you need a liquid bond market? From our perspective, we need a liquid bond market to be able to reallocate into riskier assets. And of course, that's super important for the overall market to continue to function also in very, very stressed conditions. So I think that's an example where the long-term investors also can do some good for the overall society, if you like, if you want to take it really big, that that you are in a position to move money from low risk assets to high risk assets under these circumstances. I think that's at least a crucial puzzle bit in the overall economy.
Yeah. So in some sense, the policy response that on one layer, on one sort of way of looking at it, is about supporting the function of core government bond markets, is also about supporting the transition from people like you guys from low risk assets into higher risk assets, if that's kind of, if I've understood you correctly.
Absolutely so. And during the darkest days of March last year, I was afraid that markets could close down. That was my sort of darkest thought, if you don't talk about people's lives, and that, of course, very, very hard development as well. But if you look at the pure financial markets aspect of things, I was afraid the markets could actually close down.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think, just as a quick aside, I mean, were you at all, when you say you thought markets might close down, does that relate to the treasury market as well? I mean, obviously there was, I think, a huge and underappreciated kind of aspect of the March shock is that there was significant disruption in the world's most important financial market. Is that something that you watched with concern as well, or?
I have confidence in the central banks that they sort of would do everything in their power to keep that part of the market open. I don't think that would be the authorities' prime concern, but I could see them being enough concerned with the US equity market, for example. If it drops 10% 4 days in a row, then the next measure could be to close it down for a week or so. It has happened before.
Yeah. So let's look slightly closer to the present. So we've talked about kind of the global policy response and its rationale, its sort of implications in the short term in stabilizing key markets. One of the talking points in recent months, and it's been discussed over and over again, but I want to really get your insights on this. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of talk about inflation and whether the global economic policy response is going to stoke kind of medium-term inflation. And I'd be quite keen on getting your perspective specifically on this. So there are several kind of subparts to that. I mean, A, do you think it's likely? B, how are you protecting yourself against it, and how has it kind of impacted your portfolio decision making? So let's start with that and with the two parts, the kind of the inflation puzzle and how you guys are dealing with it.
I think that's the one issue that we have spent most time on over the past 2 months, researching and trying to understand. And our conclusion is that we don't know. We can't know how the inflation development will play out. And that's because it's so complicated. It's policy issues, it's global issues, but not least, it's behavioral issues with the companies and consumers. And I think that's actually one conclusion. You have to be very open-minded about where things will go. If you look at what's happened so far, you can conclude that almost everything that leads to a 5% headline inflation in the US is directly pandemic related. It is very few groups of goods and services that lead us to observe that number. So most prices are still very well behaved and actually very close to the 2% inflation target. So that's one conclusion as well. So yes, you get a very high headline number, but that almost per definition, at least the drivers we have seen so far, per definition, are transitory. But of course, there is so much else going on around bottlenecks, global contention in various areas. Currently, we see the oil price at very high levels. And of course, policymaking is still very extreme. So there is a big risk enough that inflation will be higher and significantly higher for some time to consider it, of course, in your portfolio construction.
Well, so my question was, Torbjörn, you just said that policymaking is still very extreme, and I'm wondering if you think that it's possibly too accommodative given current economic circumstances, whether there's kind of a relaxation or a complacency that's set in among policymakers that's unwarranted. What are your thoughts on that as a pension fund?
Well, first of all, I think you can understand policymakers, so you sort of understand why they are where they are. Monetary policymaking in general have been too focused on just one dimension, the inflation target. And basically, I think policymaking in that dimension have been fighting a losing battle, and that's given everything we see in terms of lower price pressure from globalization, digitalization, and so on. Even demographics, also demographics. So, but you can't really connect that only to this period. It's been going on for a long time. And that is a problem for long-term investors going forward, because your return on your risk-free assets are so low, very difficult to both create a well-diversified portfolio and get a decent return. That's problematic. I also think it's problematic maybe when policymakers sort of fight the demographic developments because they can't really influence them. And potentially also problematic now in the US if as Fed says, they will sort of run the economy hot for everybody to get a job and get the salaries and wages up for the lowest paid part of the population. So then maybe it's difficult to run monetary policy as a tool to achieve that. So, but potentially problematic, yes.
Yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit just to get your views on some of these other issues. One thing that we hear a lot when we speak to both asset owners like yourselves and asset managers is that the conversation around ESG issues has gone from 0 to 100 for a lot of asset owners, especially in the kind of official institution segment. What's been your relationship with ESG integration in your portfolio? I mean, I a lot of pension funds were very early in fighting that battle. How has your relationship with ESG integration evolved? And has it intensified because of the pandemic, or has the pandemic kind of changed your approach to it at all?
Difficult how much you can connect to the pandemic, but no doubt our focus and most investors' focus have increased on the ESG issues in general over the past few years. They have really accelerated. And for the AP funds, I think, you know, we started something called the Council on Ethics over 15 years ago, or close to 15 years ago. And the starting point was really on ethical issues like labor rights and human rights and so on. So those issues have been very relevant with AP funds for a long time. And for about 7 years ago now,
we also start to set specific climate-related targets to our portfolio. The climate has also been very integrated in what we do for a number of years now. And that, of course, was related to the Paris Agreement and that date. I think lately more focus have come into biodiversity issues. I think that's the next big thing for long-term asset managers. So you can see that this is spreading across the board and becoming a very broad spectrum of issues. And that's, of course, challenging because each field in its own right is a very specific area. You need to learn a lot to understand the challenges and the opportunities.
When you see something like biodiversity coming up on the horizon, how would you approach that issue specifically? I mean, are you just looking to make direct investments potentially with other, you know, other AP funds or other asset owners, or are you looking to just understand the space and kind of shape it in a more indirect way? I mean, how would you approach that, like the biodiversity example specifically?
This is very early stages, I believe, except for some areas that might have been on the agenda for horizon for a while. But I think it will be a bit similar to how we approach climate risk. And that is basically mapping our portfolio against risk factors. And that's basically what we do on all sustainability-related issues. We try to map and understand how our portfolio is both exposed to risk factors and how it can influence risk factors. And I think the biodiversity issue will be similar. And of course, that's a very financial approach to things. It's very quantitative, it's very rules-based, and so on. And that might not be the solution to everything, but it's a start anyway to understand how you and your portfolio impact things.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I just on a last note, I know that you guys do a lot of impact investing across different fields. There was a recent partnership on a lithium ion battery production company with some of your fellow Swedish AP funds. How do you understand impact investing specifically within the broader framework of your portfolio construction? Is it something that you expect to grow as these considerations become more important? A few of the institutions that we work with in the official space do, but I feel like it's, especially among the pension fund community, like yourselves and PGGM and some others, it's really taking on a lot of speed. So I'd be curious to hear how you think about impact investing specifically.
No, it's very interesting that you ask, because
I thought I would be very careful to characterize our investment in
interesting.
Impact. It is found on a pure financial basis. And it's basically driven by a huge need that we see over the next several decades for a new technique and a new energy solution.
That's a very important part of electrifying our transportation fleet.
What do I mean by that? I would basically say that we are not impact investors. Our mission is to generate returns from the Swedish pension system.
But would it be fair to say that there's, obviously electric vehicle production is linked to sustainability needs. So would it be fair to say that there's, that in some sense it's a way of combining sustainability with greater financial returns? I mean, I know a lot of some of the pension funds that I speak to say, well, you know, we use sustainability as a way of identifying potential financial opportunities before they've really reached prominence. And it strikes me that that's kind of the balance that you're describing in some sense. Is that fair to say?
No, I think you're right. What investors like us now try to do is to identify where the investment needs are over the next few decades, and a lot of the large significant investment needs are in the sustainability area, not least climate solutions, of course. And of course, there is sort of a danger that too much money change similar solutions, but so far I think the balance is that more capital is needed, not less.
Fair enough. I see I this has flown by, and I see that we've already taken up quite a bit of your time. So I think we'll leave it off. We'll leave things there, unless you have anything else that you want to add specifically. I think this has been a very helpful conversation. You've given us a lot. You've shared a lot of insights with us, which is really great. Do you have anything else you wanna add or plug at this stage? Otherwise, I'm happy to call it there.
No, I think it's a super interesting time, and as an investor and this, as a citizen to the globe, lots of challenges going on and lots of hope as well, I think, for innovation to take part of the solutions and so on. Maybe a bit more challenging going forward to be an investor. I'm fairly convinced of that.
But you're relishing the prospect from the sound of it. So that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Torbjørn. And I look forward to speaking again soon.
Thank you, Pierre.
Thanks for listening in to my conversation with Torbjørn today. It was really interesting chatting about the pandemic, the global economic policy response to the pandemic, and ESG integration in pension fund portfolios with him. If you've enjoyed the podcast, you can subscribe to our channel. We're on iTunes and Spotify.
OMFIF is producing the 8th annual Global Public Investor Report devoted to best practices in public sector asset ownership and management. The global launch on July 21st hones in on a number of themes around public investment, including lessons for reserves managers from the COVID-19 shock, active ownership practices, and the nature of strategic investment relationships between asset owners and their external asset managers. The report draws in part on a new survey data set of over 100 sovereign investors with findings on a range of macro and market themes, and includes contributions from and interviews with a range of global central banks, sovereign funds, and public pension funds. The launch event will take place on July 21st. To register, click the link in the show notes or visit our website, www.omfif.org/meetings. That's www.omfif.org/meetings.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.